Hello and welcome at Book Lovers Companion. My name is Edith and the chattering teacup is enjoying some tea time in London. Dear listeners, our CEO and furry overlord is roaming the estate, making sure everything is in order. But, of course, I'm not alone. I'm not here on my own. Joining me from across the pond is author A.X. Foster. Hello, Alex, and welcome at Book Lovers Companion.
Hello, Edith, and thank you very much for inviting me to be on the show.
The question I usually ask my guests is, of course, you are aware that I'm recording this and you are fine with it. And of course, this time you do not have the right to remain silent.
Anything I say can and will be used against me. I consent.
Okay, splendid, wonderful. We are here to talk about your book, Gavel to Gavel, the Seneca County Courthouse Series book number one, which came out in June 2023. And Alex, tell our listeners what it is all about, please.
Well, thank you. My novel is the first in a series of books which focuses on the protagonist of a young prosecutor who is trying murder cases inside an American courtroom. Gavel to Gavel, the first book in the series, is about a very wealthy woman who is alleged to have murdered her husband. And the only eyewitness to the murder is their 9-year-old daughter, who is watching from the top of the stairs. So it's a murder mystery, but it's also the story of how a trial unfolds in the American court system from the start to the finish, from gavel to gavel, with the crime, the investigation, the selection of a jury, the direct and cross-examination of witnesses, all the way to a final verdict. So the readers get to be, in essence, part of the jury. And they read how the case unfolds with different evidence and testimony, and then see if they reach the same conclusion as the jury does in the book.
And your characters are quite an interesting bunch of people. The teacup would probably say it's a lot like a play. When you read through the book, it feels sometimes like a play, or you can put it on stage. Certainly, you could put it on screen. And where did the idea come from for this special case your prosecutor is trying, Mac McIntyre?
Well, I was a prosecutor of homicide cases for a long time. I was a prosecutor for 20 years. And during that time span, I did over 100 jury trials. So I used my courtroom experience to craft the story in this book. After the 20 years as a prosecutor, I opened up my own law firm as a defense attorney, where people who are charged with crimes would hire me to defend them. So I did that for the next 15 years. So I have 35 years of experience inside a courtroom. I used those experiences to craft the plot of the book and the characters and so forth. The murder in Gavel to Gavel, the novel, is based on a case that I handled as a prosecutor in part, but it's really a mixture of a couple of cases put together. So it's not the nonfiction telling of a prosecutor and a case. It's a fictional story that relies on my experience over all these years from seeing the courtroom from different perspectives.
And I also wanted to ask you about your character, your main character, Mac McIntyre. Is he a combination of more than one people, or is he completely someone who came up with?
Well, Mac McIntyre, well, so many people who have interviewed me have asked, Are you A.X. Foster? Are you Mac McIntyre? And my answer to that is yes and no, as a typical lawyer response. No, it's not me, but I took elements of how I survived the office politics, the media, the pressure to be responsive to television and the press, as well as your colleagues in the office and your opposition, the defense attorneys, the judges, the police, all of those, everything in the book really is derives from my own personal experience. But it is all a mixture. All of the characters are combinations of real people that I have been inspired by over the course of my career. So I am not Mac McIntyre, but I'm pretty close.
And in your book, we get different perspectives throughout the plot. We get the perspective of Mac. We get the perspective of the judge, or let's say her background as well. We also get the background of the defender. And the question is also for us outside, from the book, from the plot, from the story, what are the responsibilities of those players in the courtroom? What is the responsibility of the judge? What is the responsibility of the prosecutor? And what is the responsibility of the defender?
Well, let's start with the prosecutor. The prosecutor's role is to achieve justice. And that doesn't always mean just to win at all costs. For example, if a prosecutor discovers that the defendant is innocent halfway through the trial, the prosecutor is obligated under our oath as an officer of the court not to proceed with the case. So the prosecutor is in pursuit of justice. Now, the judge's role is basically to referee the proceedings. The defense attorney has different obligations. The defense attorney is obliged to defend his or her client within the rules of court and within the rules of ethical considerations. So each of the players, the prosecutor, the defense attorney, and the judge, have different roles to play as a trial unfolds.
And in this special case, the prosecutor has to deal with the witness, and the problems of this witness is twofold. For one, his main witness is a girl, a young girl of age 9. And the second thing is that the young girl has a special health problem. Let's put it that way, because that's what I see. It is a health problem. She has narcolepsy in children, which you state in your book is rather rare. It happens more often within adults, but still he has to deal with it.
Yes, well, I added that element to the case to make the plot more interesting and more challenging. The only eyewitness to a murder, and think about the position that this little girl is in. Her name is Mandy. She's just seen her mother kill her father and stab him multiple times with a kitchen knife. And so she's in a terrible conflict right there. Both her parents are in deep trouble and her father's dead. To add a layer of complexity to the plot, she suffers from pediatric narcolepsy. Now, most people are unfamiliar with narcolepsy, or at least they have a concept that, oh, people just fall asleep instantly. But narcolepsy is really more like chronic fatigue syndrome, where someone who has narcolepsy is always tired and can never fully be alert. And then with medication, they can lead a normal life, but then they're, buzzing around on amphetamines medications that have that effect. So that adds a huge challenge for Mac McIntyre, my prosecutor, because the only eyewitness to this terrible murder is a child whose testimony may be unreliable. Mm. And as you know from reading the book, in one part she falls asleep in the middle of the trial. So I added that element, but I had a lot of experience with child witnesses. I handled child abuse cases for many years, and working with children in the courtroom is a huge challenge. But and I did work with some children that had various disabilities, whether they be autistic or suffering from some various form of mental incapacity. And so that just added a challenge to the case for Mac, and I think it makes for a more interesting plot.
Absolutely, because I suppose that asking children or putting children on the witness stand is a challenge in itself, isn't it?
Yes, it is. I mean, typically a child of this age, 8, 9, 10, in Maryland, in the United States, where I practice law and where the trial takes place, there is a rule that anyone under the age of 7 years old is presumed to be incompetent as a witness. From the age of 7 to 14, there's no presumption. From 14 and older, there's a presumption that the witness is capable of testifying. So I put my character right in the middle. So she's 9 years old, but she has narcolepsy. Is she even qualified to testify in a court? And you know from one of the early scenes in the book, they have to question the child in front of the judge to make sure she understands two things: that she's in a courtroom and what's going on, a trial, and is she able to tell the truth? So those are the two qualifications that the judge needs to be satisfied before any witness can testify. And I just thought that would be interesting for the readers to go through that process, because this child's testimony is so important. I wanted to make a very difficult case for the prosecutor. It would be no fun to write a story about a case where a murderer confessed and there was a videotape and DNA and a fingerprint. I mean, that's not much of a dramatic story to tell. So I wanted to craft a case where everything was very, very close. Was it guilty? Was it innocent? Which way is the jury going to go?
And your prosecutor has to answer quite a few ethical questions for himself as well, doesn't he?
Yes. Without giving away any spoiler alerts, I can tell your listeners and viewers that about halfway through the book, in the middle of the trial, new evidence is discovered in the form of the child's diary. And is she telling the truth in court? Was she telling the truth in her diary? How can the prosecutor handle this huge disruption to the presentation of his case? That becomes the main ethical concern for Mac McIntyre, the prosecutor in this case. And then you have some other ethical considerations woven into the story, because there's a subplot of sexual harassment. His boss is a female boss, and he's a man, and she's putting a lot of pressure on him to have a relationship. And so as a subplot to the main plot of the murder trial, we learn about office politics and how to deal with a Me Too kind of movement. But I reversed the genders so that it was a young man who was being sexually harassed by an older woman.
That was an interesting twist in this Me Too problem. I found it interesting because it is rarely used in books, to be honest. And maybe because of the fact that men are more often the predators in this case, I suppose. And sometimes also, I guess, I am just guessing here, that women are often underestimated as predators.
That I wanted to incorporate in the book. The switching of the gender roles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and women are often seen more like the motherly type, I suppose, especially if they are in a role of a higher authority, maybe, I don't know. And we do not, or a society sometimes does not think that women are capable. Like I said, women are often underestimated. We do not think women are capable of, or not so often capable of, being predators in this kind of activity. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, but that's what makes for a more interesting book. I mean, and I think it happens, you know. It may not happen as much as an older man, you know, a Bill Clinton, a Monica Lewinsky, a Harvey Weinstein, I mean, Roger Ailes. There are many, many examples of rich and powerful men who prey on vulnerable younger women. But for my book, I thought it would be interesting to switch it around and make his boss, who has power over his career, be the one putting pressure on a young man. And how does he navigate that? Because, as you know from reading the book, he finds himself in a trap where there appears to be no escape. If he tells the woman, if he rejects her, then she could ruin his career. But if he goes forward and has an affair with her, that's obviously going to be create terrible problems. So your readers will have to read the book to see how Mac extricates himself from this trap.
Oh, yeah. Quite interesting and quite clever, I might add. Absolutely, absolutely fascinating to read that. Also, in your book, you have incorporated quite a number of legal documents. So it makes or gives the reader the feel of a slightly non-fiction book. It feels a bit like a combination of fiction and non-fiction, incorporating those legal documents. Is that, or was that, the intention from the beginning?
Right. I don't know where the idea came from, but I decided to put some realistic documents as chapters in the book. I have a newspaper article it's fictitious, of course, mm-hmm. but one of the characters in the story is a reporter. And so you have a newspaper article, mm-hmm. and then I include a DNA report, which mm-hmm. shows it's very realistic, because what I did was I went back through my old case files and pulled out a real DNA report, and then, of course, changed all the names to match the characters in my book. Mm-hmm. I have a blood spatter analysis. The murder is a very bloody scene with blood spattered all over the rooms and even on the ceiling. And I used that from a real case that I did once where there was blood on the ceiling, which I found remarkable. Like, how violent is that? And we hired a blood spatter analyst to tell us about medium velocity and high powered velocity. And the forensics, the science, can tell a lot about a case. When you do a trial, people testify in words and they're using their memory, and it can often be very faulty, but scientific evidence will tell a story in a way that people can't. So I have a blood spatter analysis, the DNA report, as I said, and then I offer some legal documents, the definition of terms that the jury would hear, and so on. I use them in five different chapters, and I think it does lend an air of authenticity mm-hmm. and realism to the story. Now, in mm-hmm. my second book that I'm just getting ready to publish, May 1st, it goes to the publisher, because people, my readers, really like those inclusion of the legal documents, I have 7 in the next book. I went from 5 to 7. And those include things like a ballistics report with how they match bullets and that sort of thing, because people are fascinated with the forensics and the science. and TV shows like CSI are sort of in the mindset of the public now. And by putting those things in the book, I think it adds a lot. And my readers have told me, have been very favorable about that techniques.
That's true. And I mean, CSI is probably very, very popular, or was very popular. But I always compare it with British shows, of course. And I was always wondering, why for in the world are they not suited up? You know, they are going in a hotel room or a apartment or a house, and just like they came from the streets, and they are just trudging through the crime scene, and yeah, just gloves, and that's it. Then you watch a British TV show, and they're all suited up, and they put protection on their shoes, and they put on a mask and whatnot.
Yeah, I mean, the realistic way is to have people suited up and very, very careful about contaminating a crime scene. I don't know why the TV shows don't do that. Maybe it doesn't look right. But in my experience, having been to many crime scenes, the first thing you do is you seal off the crime scene, and the fewer people that are trampling around, they're polluting it. And now DNA has become so sensitive that how you handle it is very important, because a single contamination can ruin the evidence and really hurt your case. So I do have I have a chapter on the DNA collection and so forth in Gavel, and I think readers responded well to that.
Mm-hmm. I can imagine that. I mean, it's always fascinating to read what's going on behind the scenes, so to speak. And I wanted to ask you about this change of defenders, because in your book we have this very rich now widow, and she has this very high-profile defender for the start of her trial, legal proceedings, and then she is thrown to a public defender, more or less. Someone who is, well, has not the profile the first one has. What can you tell us about that? Because he seemed like an intriguing character, your high-profile defender.
Well, I'm glad you said that, because that man's name is Marcel St. Croix, my French-Canadian, half-Indian, half-white defense attorney, the flamboyant Marcel. And he actually takes on a much more prominent role in book two. He's the lead lawyer throughout the entire book two. So other people were interested in that character of Marcel. And so I elevated and expanded his role for book two. And he is based on a real guy that, when I was a very young lawyer, there was a lawyer similar to him, not exactly, but I based that character off someone who I first came in contact with when I was a brand new prosecutor, age 25 or so. But you talked about the switch of lawyers. Now, in America, it's all about money. And if you're wealthy, you can hire the best lawyers. If you're poor, you have to be assigned a public defender. Usually the public defender is young, fresh out of law school, looking for experience, but doesn't have a lot of experience. Mm. So in the book, even though she's wealthy, my alleged murderer, Ricky Vanderhook, even though Ricky is charged with murder and has money, her money is frozen because it's all connected to her husband, who she killed. So the plot is, she started out, remember, Marcel St. Croix wanted $500,000 to represent her. Yeah. But then her money all got frozen and she had no ability to pay him. And then there was also, if you recall, an ethical concern. She tells Marcel some things she shouldn't say, and he feels ethically that he could no longer properly defend her. So he pulls out of the case. And then she has to get her own public defender, Santiago. And Santiago actually is a very good lawyer. And you know from reading the book, he wants very much to be a judge. So all of his motivation is tied up with defending his client, but also to make himself look worthy of being elected judge or appointed judge. So each of the characters has a lot of ethical struggles. Everyone in the book, like every person I've ever met, all people have combinations of good and bad and good motives and bad motives and selfish motives and unselfish motives. And I think that just makes all of the characters realistic. But that's to answer your question. That's why she has to switch lawyers after the case starts.
Mm. You just said everyone is a combination of good and bad, like we all are. Is it the case that we do hold people who have public office, like a judge or a prosecutor, to a higher standard? Should we hold them to a higher standard?
Well, nobody's above the law, of course. And some of the things that happen in the book, you have prosecutors doing things that are unethical, unfair, and even perhaps illegal. So we do hold people to a higher standard, but I think the point of my book is everybody is susceptible to their own selfish motives. And Mac McIntyre wants to win this case at all costs because he knows that this woman killed her husband. And the question is not, did she do it, but do they have enough evidence to prove she did it? And that's how it was when I was a prosecutor. You don't prosecute someone if you have doubts of their guilt. The question is never, did they do it or not? The question is always, do we have enough evidence to prove they did it? And that's kind of the framework that I used in Gavel to Gavel. Because this diary that comes out can be tremendously damaging to his case. So what does he do with the diary? Does he bring it to the defense and kill his case and let this murderer go free? Or does he take a different path to win the case and make sure that the murderer is found guilty? Your viewers and listeners will have to read the book to find out what the choice is.
Absolutely. And it is a great book and it's a great read. And being in a courtroom is a bit like being on stage, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Absolutely. No doubt. And my background in university was as a stage actor. Mm. When I was young, I wanted to be the next great Shakespearean actor. And that didn't pan out, but I ended up going to law school. And then I found a different kind of stage, and that would be the courtroom. Now, when you're a prosecutor or a defense attorney, you're not playing a role per se, because you're not acting out a different person. But if you have knowledge of presentation skills and how to speak and how to move and how to gesticulate and how to present charts and how to present evidence, all of those actor skills become a huge help when you're in the courtroom trying to persuade an audience of a jury. Your jury is no different than an actor on a stage before an audience. So those skills, those theater skills, I definitely have seen, at least in the way American trials work. You could be a very smart lawyer, but if you're boring and don't present a good case, people aren't going to buy it. And if you have the ability to keep the jury's attention and keep them interested and keep them focused, you have a much better chance of getting the verdict that you desire.
And is it a bit like telling a story in so far when you present your case, you have to capture your audience, the jury's attention and hold it and bring your point home? And this requires great skills, also eloquency. Is that something you can train for, you do train for in law school, or not at all?
When I was in law school, they didn't have a class on presentation skills. But they did have something called moot court. Maybe your readers or your viewers have heard of it. Moot court, which is basically a fake court. And you go up and you act out the roles of the litigants, the lawyers, and you have other students who play witnesses. And you do like little plays. Mm-hmm. And so with my acting background, I was very attracted to doing moot court. And in fact, when I was in law school, I won the moot court tournament for the whole law school and then represented my law school against other law schools in moot court tournaments. And so, yes, that was a huge help, but they don't offer, I often thought it would be great to have a class like acting for lawyers as part of law school. But I think doing moot court fulfilled that role for me. And I love doing moot court. And then I also did an internship when I was a third year law student with the local DA's office. And that's when I really fell in love with the process of being a courtroom lawyer. And I did an internship. In fact, the very first trial that I ever presented, it was a very simple case now that I look back on it, but I prepared like crazy because it was my first time ever doing that. And in the state where I went to law school, they had a provision where law students could go to court as long as they had a real prosecutor sitting at the table next to them. And my supervisor was so nice and elegant. And she said, you can do the whole case. And I was like, really? And I ended up doing it. And it was a lot of fun. And that convinced me very, very much that I wanted to be a prosecutor.
Mm. This might sound like a very personal question, and you do not have to answer that, of course. Do you think that especially those lawyers who are very successful, be it as a defender or as a prosecutor, that those people have certain character traits or a certain personality that is different from those who are not that successful?
Yes, I mean, absolutely. There are no shy prosecutors. There are very few inverted and shy defense attorneys. It is a profession that requires boldness. It requires confidence. It requires a certain amount of egocentricity, which I think was the area you were steering the question to. You can't be a great prosecutor without having a certain kind of ego and fighting capability. You have to be like a gladiator. And shy people don't tend to go in that direction. So I do think you're formed with certain skills. And if you don't have them, they're very hard to learn. It's impossible to learn how to be aggressive or learn how to be commanding or charisma. Charisma is something that is very hard to teach. You either naturally have it or you don't. And so the people that gravitate towards these jobs are strong people, articulate people, intelligent, and competitive. You have to be competitive because it's about winning and losing. And you learn with the verdict of every jury trial whether you won or lost, if by the simple words of guilty or not guilty. So there are very few careers that people have where they're constantly being rewarded by their good work. Many lawyers write briefs and they file papers and, you know, they never get that instant gratification. I love that part. It's more like a professional athlete who goes and plays a game. Mm-hmm. You win or you lose, and then you have another game. You're not going to win every game, but you enjoy the competition and you enjoy the resolution. Mm-hmm. The resolution is you won your case or you didn't. Mm-hmm.
Ah, true. Is that the reason why so many politicians were former lawyers?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Being a lawyer is a great foundation for doing a debate against a political opponent, making speeches, persuading an audience. In the wider sense, a candidate for office has to persuade the citizens to vote for him or her and your constituency. Yeah. So, yes, I think there are some parallels between politicians and lawyers.
Mm. And during writing this book, because there is so much involved of the courtroom drama, of the case, of the background that's going on in the book and with the people Mac has to deal with, what was your writing process throughout? Because I'm asking this because people who listen to our podcast are often interested in how other authors do that, because some of them have spreadsheets, some of them have murder walls, so to speak, when they write crime fiction. How was your process in writing this book, writing your draft?
Well, everyone does it differently, but I like to prepare. And when I had the idea for the story, I was fortunate because I was able to follow the path that every trial takes. Every trial has a beginning, a middle, and an end. You begin with the discovery of a crime. You investigate the crime. You charge the crime. You go to court. You pick a jury. You have motions. You have testimony. You have evidence that's put into court in terms of documents, or photographs, mm-hmm. or mm-hmm. maps, or charts, or what have you. Mm-hmm. The jury gets to deliberate, and then they come up with a resolution. So there's a natural shape that follows the classic theater or fiction shape of rise mm-hmm. and fall. Mm-hmm. And so I already had that architecture. Mm-hmm. was already in place for me. Then I had to work in the various subplots, the sexual harassment in his office. Mm-hmm. Some of the other characters have their own access to grind. And then I wove those in. But what I did for my process is I like to see it all at once. I get frustrated when I have to scan through a manuscript and either flip pages or mm-hmm. or roll my computer screen back and forth, up and down. So what I do is I take a huge piece of paper about the size of a blackboard, a poster size, and I write the chapters up and then down in the shape of an inverted triangle. So they rise to a denouement, to a peak, and then mm-hmm. they come down to a resolution. Oh. And I just write in each of the chapters. In Gavel to Gavel, I think I have 89 chapters, very short. I have 89 four or five page chapters. Yeah. In my second book that's coming out this year, which is called Double Blind, I have the same, I want them to look uniform. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I have the same formula. I have about 80 chapters that are each mm-hmm. about five or six pages to keep the thing moving quickly. Mm-hmm. Pace yeah. is very yeah, important. Yeah. I want the reader to turn the page. What happens next? What happens yeah. next?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. That happens with short chapters and the lots of chapters. It's the story picks up speed, so to speak. Yeah, absolutely. And the question might sound silly, but I do have to ask you, for you, since we've touched upon TV shows already, what would be, for you personally, the best depiction of a lawyer on screen, and which would be the worst?
Oh, my. Well, I get asked this question quite a bit. And of all the TV shows and movies, I have a personal favorite from childhood, which is To Kill a Mockingbird, mm. where Gregory Peck yeah. plays the defense attorney, Atticus Finch. Yeah. And I've wanted to be a courtroom lawyer ever since I saw that movie mm. as a little boy. But there's one movie that I think captures what a courtroom lawyer does realistically quite well, and that would be The Lincoln Lawyer mm-hmm. with Matthew McConaughey. Yeah. And I'm sorry, I'm juggling around here, but there's a scene where Matthew McConaughey asks questions of a defendant. And that comes very close to how I used to do it in court in terms of the pacing and the probing Mm-hmm. And that's one that jumps out to me as very realistic. The ones on TV are not as realistic because they have these time constraints and they have to solve a whole murder in 1 hour. And I don't think I've ever seen a case solved in an hour. So there's an artificiality attached with that format to begin with. And the movie format or book format is better.
Yeah, it usually is. Also, the walking and talking again. I have to ask you again, we've spoken about it before, but there was this one TV show, I mentioned it before when we spoke, a UK TV show called Silk. And there is this young up-and-coming lawyer, and he has to more or less help his colleague out, and he starts walking and talking in the courtroom, you know, and the judge says, Mr. I don't can't remember his name, this is a British courtroom. We don't do walking and talking.
Well, there are different rules, you know. There are 50 United States, and then there's a federal system. I have been in court where you're not allowed to move from behind the lectern, where you must stay behind that little standing desk. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But in Maryland, in state court, there are no rules about that. And I always moved around the courtroom. There are certain places you can stand that are better. But I think the movement, the walking and talking, as you say, it keeps the attention of the jury. I mean, people like to see things that are moving, you know, like a tennis match. They turn their heads back and forth. Yeah. And that shows that they're watching. So I was one of those walker and talkers. And when I gave an opening statement or a closing argument, I usually would put my paperwork right on the table. And then I would tell the story without looking at the papers. And then if I needed to go back and see, like, what's the next section, I would look down and then tell this part of the story. But I think it was much more interesting to move around the stage like a stand-up comic. You know, you see how they move? That's kind of the way that I used to move in a courtroom.
Oh, okay. Interesting. Interesting also the different rules in different states and so on. Absolutely. And you said last time when we spoke, you have been to the Old Bailey and you had the pleasure of watching how it is done in the UK.
Yes, I had a great experience. I love London. I love to travel. One of my main hobbies is international travel. As you know, I just got back from the Netherlands. Holland has a very special place in my heart. I go there every year. But I've been to London, and I love it there. And I was fortunate enough to be invited when I was a prosecutor to sit in on a murder trial in the Old Bailey in London. And to me, it was fascinating to watch because there were so many similarities between the way, you know, classic English law was presented with American law. There were so many similarities because American law is derived from Anglo law. Mm-hmm. We're all rebels, you know, but we rebelled against the crown and we formed our own country, the United States of America. But our law comes from England. Now, interestingly, there's one state in America where the law derives from French law primarily, and that would be Louisiana, which was once a French territory. And there are elements of Spanish law in the western part of the United States, in Texas, New Mexico, California, community property states. So historically, it's interesting how different parts of America, being such a huge country, have traditions that evolved from other European countries. But where I practice is a very old part of America, Maryland, Washington, D.C., Baltimore. And the rules that we follow are... they're all derived from English law, but they're so much more relaxed. Mm-hmm. You know, in England, we don't wear little white wigs on our head. And they talked in ways that were very formal compared to what I'm used to in America. But the rules of evidence, hearsay, improper foundation, All those kind of evidentiary concerns all derive from English case law.
And Alex, now that you have published not one book, the second one is coming out very soon, like you said, what would be your advice for any other author who might like to write a courtroom drama or just in general?
Well, I think you have to write what you know, as the classic cliche goes. I mean, I didn't write a book about astronauts going to the moon because I don't know anything about that. And I didn't write a book about a surgeon doing a heart transplant because I don't know anything about that. But I did write a book about a murder trial because I do know about that. I've done murder trials. I've done many of them. I've seen a lot of dead bodies. I've been to crime scenes. Mm. I've worked with forensics, with DNA, ballistics, fingerprint, hair fibers, all those things. So I write about what I know, and your readers or your listeners should write about their own life experiences, because otherwise it won't have any authenticity. Now, I've read some books, legal thrillers. I read them as many as I can to see, you know, what my competition is or what other people are doing. And I can tell right away if the author is a courtroom lawyer or a journalist or somebody who wants to be a lawyer. It will lack a certain authenticity in the details. So I would advise to write about what you know and write, and don't write with a view towards how am I going to get this published? because publishing is a whole different question. I mean, you can write a book and no one will ever publish it, but you have to write what you know. But if you want to write a commercial book like mine that you want people to pick up and go to the beach, or they're in the airport and they're looking for something fun and exciting and light and easy to read, my kind of book, I want people, that's my marketplace, that's my audience, people that enjoy fiction. So I wrote it with an eye towards it being commercial, and I was lucky enough that it ended up being popular that way. And then there's all the social media. I have a Facebook page. I would invite any of your listeners to look me up on Facebook at AX Foster Author. I have an Instagram. I have a website, axfoster.com. You know, all that stuff nowadays is changing the face of publishing. Mm-hmm. Traditional publishing is being is one avenue, but going on Amazon, which goes around the world. I mean, you're in Austria right now. There's no way you would ever even know about my book were it not for Amazon and the international. True. The internet is so pervasive. I read recently that 80% of books in America are bought on Amazon. 80%.
Yep.
You know, when I grew up before Amazon, you'd go to the bookstore, you'd go to a library.
Yep.
People don't buy books that way anymore. So these are all of the considerations that people should have when they write a book. But first, you have to want to tell a story and then worry about the commercial aspects and the publishing later.
So, yeah, good advice. And Alex, can you touch a little bit more upon your future plans? Because you said book two is coming out very soon, but I know there's something else in the making, which I said, is right down my lane.
Well, I've written the second book. I see a series of at least three books. I'm already working on the third book. And then I also want to write in a totally different genre, which is historical fiction. I have a great love of history. And now I mentioned that I had just gotten back from the Netherlands. I have an idea to write a book about an historical event that happened a long time ago in Dutch history, which was the assassination of Prince William of Orange. also known as William the Silent, in the year 1584. Yes, that's right. I said 1584, when Spain and the provinces of the Netherlands were at war. There was an assassination of the leader of the Dutch side, if you will. And that happened in the town of Delft. And it was the first assassination in world history with a handgun. And I've been to the site of the murder. Like I said, I've been to a lot of crime scenes. And as I think we discussed before, I took a look at the evidence. They have bullet holes in the wall of a staircase. And allegedly, the prince was killed on the staircase by an intruder into the palace. And I took one look at the layout of the scene and the story that the guide was telling me. And all of my prosecutorial instincts told me that this was not correct. And it reminded me a lot of the assassination of John F. Kennedy. You know, I've been to Dealey Plaza in Dallas. I've been on the sixth floor of the Texas School Book Depository building, where Lee Harvey Oswald shot President Kennedy with a rifle from above. I've been there. I've been right at that window and looked. And I'm convinced that he was the lone assassin. But many other people believe in the grassy knoll and a conspiracy and the CIA. And no will ever fully be satisfied with what happened in the assassination of John Kennedy. So I kind of want to blend some elements of that story with the Prince of Orange in Holland. And that's my idea for a book, to make it a murder mystery set in 16th century Holland.
And how big is the danger of you falling into the rabbit hole of research?
You know, I've been researching it for many years, so I will not be that kind of historical fiction writer that's obsessed with the clothing and the food and the technology and the horses. And I'm going to get a little bit into that, but I'm going to tell a murder mystery story in a setting that is, 400 years ago. So I've done a lot of the research, but for me, the main research was going to the murder scene. I've now been there many times, actually. And I also engaged with a Dutch expert on that crime. And he was very knowledgeable about everything to do with it. A professor in Holland. Okay. And I met with him, and he gave me some excellent advice. So I'm not that intimidated by the research. I think the research is pretty much behind me. I just need to get my legal thrillers done and then, as a labor of love, try a whole new type of book.
Ah, okay. Like I said before, absolutely intriguing. Absolutely my kind of book.
Excellent.
And Alex, is there anything else you would like our listeners to know?
Well, I've written a book in Gavel to Gavel, which is in the great tradition of legal thrillers, along the lines, if you like John Grisham, if you like Scott Turow, James Patterson, if those are the authors that you enjoy reading, hopefully you will take a look at my book and see if it fits within your expectations. And again, if you would like to connect with me, I'm easy to find on social media. I have I enjoy getting online every day and discussing the book and other legal issues. We got a lot going on in America right now. We have the former president, Donald Trump, is on trial. As you can imagine, it's unprecedented to have a former president as a criminal defendant. A lot of people are talking about it. A lot of people asking me questions. So I enjoy the dialogue with my fans. And anyone out there who would like to connect, please just look up AX Foster on your Google search, and it will bring you to my website, my book on Amazon, and my Facebook page. And I would like to keep building my reader base. And so please reach out to me and join, and I'd be very happy to connect with anyone who's listening to this program.
Splendid. So, Alex, thank you for joining me, for doing this, for talking to me. It was an absolute pleasure.
Well, thank you, Edith. It's a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you for the opportunity. And I'll be back when my next book is published.
Absolutely. You have an invitation. I will join you shortly in the green room. Don't go away.
Thank you. Auf Wiedersehen.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this conversation as much as we did. And we hope we'll meet again in our next show. Until next time.